From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, in Mountain View, where nearly 60% of residents are renters, the average monthly rent jumped more than 50% from 2011 to 2015. In response, advocates in many small Bay Area cities, including Mountain View, Burlingame, and San Mateo, have put rent control measures on November's ballot. Forum debates these measures and discusses what it means that campaigns for rent control, normally found in large urban areas, are migrating to the suburbs. Join us for the hour as we hear pros and cons next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. There are five Bay Area voter initiative ballot measures that would establish rent and eviction controls in San Mateo, Mountain View, Burlingame, Alameda, and Richmond, and a measure in Oakland that would strengthen existing rent control protections. How will these measures fare as the migration of rent control to the suburbs comes under voter scrutiny? Joining us for this morning's discussion and debate as part of our ongoing election 2016 coverage here in studio is Juliet Brody, law professor at Stanford and director of the Stanford Community Law Clinic, which is representing the campaign for Yes on V. And we welcome you to the program. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
Also say good morning to Tom Bannon, who joins us this morning as well. He's the CEO of the California Apartment Association. Tom Bannon, welcome to the Forum program.
Thank you.
And Devin Katayama is also with us here in studio, East Bay reporter for KQED. And welcome, Devin.
Thank you so much.
Let me begin with you, Devin. Let's begin by, we ought to say that rent control is clearly spreading, or at least measures are spreading to the suburbs. Is this rent control, as it's pretty much traditionally been in places like Berkeley, San Francisco, East Palo Alto, or for that matter, Santa Monica?
It's very similar. And a lot of these, actually all of these ballot measures are asking for similar things. And that is to put a limit on the amount that landlords and property owners can raise rent, but also to implement just cause evictions, essentially meaning that you can only be evicted for certain reasons, like not paying rent or damage to the property. Those two measures or laws kind of go hand in hand. And so what you're seeing is slight variations in each of these cities, but for the most part, they look very similar.
But presently, landlords can and do essentially charge what the market will bear. And also, when a lease ends, they can evict tenants at will.
Yeah, and I mean, there is a state law called Costa-Hawkins, which essentially exempts newer buildings built after 1995 from these renter protections. That's actually one of the arguments that you hear from the property owners, is that the landlords who have been around for a long time or have at least owned buildings which are older are taking a lot of the responsibility for the rise in the number of jobs and the cities not creating enough housing. So some of the newer buildings, the high rises that we're seeing being built, anything built after 1995 is not subject to these rent controls.
But those who argue against rent control, and for example, the Legislative Analyst's Office has put out a statement that says for low-income families, what we need is more housing and more residential development. And lots of economists say rent control just doesn't work. Even Paul Krugman, a well-known moderate progressive thinker. So we're talking about a balance, aren't we, between what's needed in the way of housing and what may be perhaps just a stopgap measure for many people?
Yeah, and I mean, if you speak to anybody who supports rent control, the renter advocates, it really is about preserving the communities that exist here now. And, almost everybody has a story about, oh, I have a friend or family member that had to move out of the Bay Area. Maybe it's to Antioch. Maybe it's to Hayward. Maybe it's to Stockton. And then those people could cause future displacement in those cities. So you hear that argument a lot. And I think at the heart of it is who shares in this responsibility for this problem, which really is like this regional problem of a boom in the number of jobs and not that much housing being built.
And I'm looking at a new report, which you may have seen. Rents are falling in San Jose and in San Francisco.
Certain areas. In Oakland, I believe that report said that
They're
not falling there. So you do – that's what's unique about each of these ballot measures. You go into each city and you hear similar stories from people who are being displaced, but the cities look different. I was in Burlingame this weekend and I met with some of the tenants groups who were working on campaigning there. And, they mentioned how Burlingame has this 1950s feel. It has this small town feel. The council members are homeowners. They want to keep that. you know, that feel of the city. But at the same time, it's just not sustainable for the, what is it, 52% of residents there who are renters. And so in a lot of these cities, you see 50% or more renters, which I think will play a part at the ballot. But, you know, that's the question of who is going to be sharing in this responsibility and who makes up the, you know, majority of the power in these areas.
Let me talk with you just for a moment about, and we'll have a debate on rent control in this hour. But in Oakland, the city council placed this measure on the ballot, and essentially it would make present rent adjustment program more favorable for tenants. But we get into, with each of these measures, the power of the city council as opposed to, you know, citizens bringing across a measure. And there's, in many cases, locked horns here.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned Oakland. Oakland's a little bit more progressive when you compare it to these other cities that we're talking about having ballot measures. I know Richmond tried to place a moratorium on rent increases recently. That was blocked by the city council and the mayor there. Also, in the ballot measures being played out along the peninsula, and the city councils in these cities are actually writing the argument against some of these ballot measures, and they, you know, are, have worked to either slow down or propose their own solutions to the issue. And a lot of the times, I mean, in Mountain View, for example, in Alameda, the city has a competing ballot measure. And a lot of the tenants groups believe that this will not only water down, but maybe even confuse some voters when they go to vote. So you do see the councils and you do see the elected leaders playing a part in the narrative and how this plays out.
Devin Katayama here with us in studio, East Bay reporter for KQED. Devin, thank you for outlining what we're dealing with here, which again is struggling with soaring rents and voting on rent control measures as a result. Appreciate your being with us.
Thanks.
And again, let me introduce the two guests who will presumably lock some horns themselves here. Juliette Brody here in studio with us, law professor at Stanford and director of the Stanford Community Law Clinic, which is representing the campaign for Yes on V. And Tom Bannon is with us online, CEO for California Apartment Association. Juliette, let me begin with you. You're very involved in Mountain View, but actually you've got a whole cohort of lawyers here who are sort of banding together to help these activists in different cities.
Well, yes, I think, a cohort of lawyers. We've got a team of lawyers and policy folks and, most importantly, community members, all of whom are learning from one another and facing together the essentially city council intransigence on the peninsula to respond to community needs for rent stabilization. So it's not just lawyers. We've got the economists we're talking to, and most importantly, as I say, the tenants themselves, who dedicated hours and months and essentially over a year throughout the peninsula trying to go to their city council, get some relief. And when that proved unsuccessful, looked for technical assistance and support from professionals who could help advance it in the ballot.
Well, you're trying clearly to do something about the displacement problem. I mean, it is catastrophic, and you've got 40% rent raises going on. Not illegal to do that. I mean, simply, in fact, not only legal, but totally permissible and often the case. What do you do with the argument, though, that rent stabilization won't solve the problem? You got too much of a problem, a shortage of housing.
I embrace that argument, and I say absolutely. Rent stabilization or rent control, whatever you call it, it's not designed to fix the housing crisis. I couldn't agree more that we've got a supply and demand problem, and building is part of the answer, although I should say I agree with Devin that we need to build up and down the income spectrum, not just luxury apartments. But of course, supply and demand is the problem. The question is, while we undertake what, let's be honest, is going to be a decades-long campaign of building, whether we're going to have the political will to do that or not, but let's assume we undertake that campaign, rent stabilization is about preventing community destabilization in the meantime.
So you quantify this by saying it's kind of putting the finger in the dike for now?
It's putting the finger in the dike, and it's also preserving the kind of communities that has made Silicon Valley and made the peninsula a very desirable place to live. You know, the times that I have heard folks say the thing they love most about Mountain View, for example, is its diversity. When you look up and down the peninsula, Mountain View is a place that has people up and down the income spectrum. They work in all kinds of industries. And that is a reason, it's one of the reasons it is such a desirable place to live. But that is at great, great jeopardy. The very character of these diverse communities is at stake.
So, Tom Bannon, you are in general opposed to rent control. Feel it's a failed policy, and the suburbanization of rent control would not be satisfactory, I'm sure, to you, unless there was some kind of means testing, or maybe even then. But shorting houses, you would agree with Juliet, is the problem. Why not have this stopgap measure? Why not have a way to keep the communities the way they are, at least for the present?
Well, Michael, you are correct. We do think it is a supply issue. I think what everybody has to sort of come to grips with is that property owners and folks make an investment in housing with the intention of certain specific rules. And if those rules are changed, then other public policy issues get impacted. But bottom line is that rent control does not address the issue. At best, it may serve a very quick relief for those tenants that currently occupy a rental unit, but it does nothing to actually address the problem.
Well, the concern, I suppose, of those in your camp is that sometimes people who don't need to be protected, who can certainly afford rents, have a disincentive to move and they stay where they are. But this is designed in many ways to protect those families who are unable to afford and who can't make payments, who are hurt by these big rises in the cost of them.
But once again, I mean, I think it comes down to really two things, Michael. First of all, just as I think you mentioned earlier, none of these ordinances have any type of income check. So if the idea is that you want to basically preserve housing opportunities and hold the rents for working class families, none of these proposals do anything. And consequently, what you can have is that you can have folks, households that are $150,000, and they will still reap the benefits of that rent being controlled. So it doesn't work.
I think you see this as being like a kind of price control, like trying to put caps on food or soap, something like that?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think the issue is that, you know, private housing is not a public utility. If, in fact, there is a desire to turn private housing into a public utility, then I think that debate needs to take place, and owners that make an investment need to know that up front, because under the current proposals, you have people that basically put their life savings into purchasing an apartment building with the idea that here are the specific rules. I can do sort of what I want to do within market constraints. And so rent control really does change that. And once again, rent control doesn't add one unit to the affordable housing.
And Tom Bannon, CEO of the California Apartment Association. Let me go back to Juliet Brody, who again is heading up Law Clinic, which is representing a campaign for Yes on V and trying to get these measures through in a number of suburbs. Rent control, the argument also goes, Juliet, encourages owners to cut back on maintenance and repairs. That was also in the legislative analyst report.
So I'd like to respond to a couple of the points that Tom has made. And even, Michael, to your characterization of isn't rent control a price ceiling? I think it's very important for listeners to understand that the kind of quote-unquote rent control that essentially all economists think is bad for markets, that kind of rent control, the reason, because economists proved that that did have so many negative effects, we don't have that kind of rent control anymore. No one is talking about a price ceiling. Modern rent control, what we call rent control 2.0, which is what is in place in the existing California, 13 California cities that have it, and it's exclusively what is on these ballots, is very different from the kind of price ceiling that economists have decry.
You've been making that analogy pretty consistently.
The analogy?
I mean, those who are opposed to rent control. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's just false. It's just false. So the biggest examples of why is 2.0 different from your grandfather's rent control? By operation of law in California, no new construction can be subject to rent control. There's no price fixing. So new construction is exempt. Number two, something that experts call vacancy decontrol, which means whenever a tenant moves out of an apartment, the market, the landlord can set the rent for the new tenant at whatever the quote-unquote market will bear. There's no price ceiling that says, well, the rent for this apartment is $1,250 no matter who moves in and who moves out. Rent control 2.0 controls the rate of increase for existing tenants. So in that, it is a policy preference for existing tenants. There's no question we have to make choices. These are anti-displacement measures. But the rent control 2.0 is not what economists are saying is so bad.
Does this mean that you would go countervailing to the argument that it encourages owners to cut back on maintenance and repairs?
That's the
legislative analyst's office says.
Yeah, well, I haven't actually read that report, but I've seen all kinds of studies that show. I mean, let's just say I don't think that's true. If that were true, then communities that don't have rent control, you would see no maintenance problems. If it's rent control that prevents landlords from taking care of their buildings, then every town that doesn't have rent control should have perfectly maintained buildings. And I'm asking you, drive through Mountain View, Redwood City, Daly City, all these communities that have no tenant protections, no rent control, and you certainly don't see 100% compliance with building and housing codes.
What do you say to this, Tom Bannon?
Well, I think the issue is that yes, vacancy decontrol does in fact allow the owner whose property is under rent control to increase the rents to the market rate. But what ends up happening is, what ends up happening is that the property owner will in fact, when that is the case, will look for those individuals, those families that have the highest credit score, they are going to be incredibly careful in terms of who goes into that unit. And so ultimately what happens is that the very people that are supposedly going to be protected by rent control, their housing opportunities are significantly diminished. And the other thing I would say is that it is not true that, you know, an individual that has a rent-controlled unit, that they are going to basically put dollars into that unit to keep it as updated as possible once they know that they have a tenant that could be in place for 5, 10, 15, 20 years. And that just doesn't make any sense to anybody. People don't move because they have a rent-controlled unit. And a lot of those folks, and once again, the proponents of rent control do not want to address this issue. Somebody who's making $150,000 in the city of Mountain View will now have, if this measure passes or any of these measures, that person will now have their rent basically controlled by government. And that does not work for what the intention of, I think, the advocates, well-intended to basically provide housing opportunities.
But there are people who are making $150,000. In fact, there was a portrait of a young woman who went to work at NASA, and she said, you know, this was the dream salary, and she was paying half of her salary to rent and really couldn't afford, felt she was living an impoverished life.
But, Michael, that goes back to the whole issue, and the whole issue, basically, it's about supply. And you know what? The challenge, I think, for everybody is that if you're going to bring in a number of new employees and you want economic vitality in a region, you have to build the housing that is commensurate with the jobs that come into the region. Not doing that creates serious problems.
And what about in all of this, Hilliard Brody, Costa Hawkins? I mean, it places limits on rent and also on eviction control, doesn't it?
Well, it doesn't place any limits on rent. What it places limits on is city governments, both voter initiative and city council's ability to regulate increases. It says that all you can do is regulate increases. You, in fact, can't regulate rents. You cannot regulate incoming starting rents. And if I could just I'd like to talk a little bit about the supply and demand problem and the quote-unquote market for rent right now. I mean, one of the things that I think goes unsaid here is that the current market rents, quote-unquote market rents, opponents of rent control talk about the free market as if there were some, you know, natural law happening here that just by virtue of their hard work and good investment, they're able to capture these rents in some sense that is free. When in fact we're seeing the results of decades of opposition to building housing, including affordable housing, that has created the supply and demand problem. The reason that landlords can get $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 a month for rent is because we don't have enough supply. It's not fair that landlords alone are able to reap the benefits and put into their pockets the profits from this situation that all of society has created. Silicon Valley is a very desirable place to live, and a lot of factors have gone into making it desirable. The jobs, the environment, the community, the breathtaking beauty, the vitality of the neighborhoods, and why should with inadequate supply, that means rents can go very high, and for landlords to talk about this as some natural market, when in fact it's the product of social policy, and now we need to recalibrate.
Tom Bannon, let's hear from you on that. It's not a simple question of supply and demand, as I think it was analyzed by Professor Brody here, but not maybe the kind of supply and demand you would want to bring into the argument.
Well, I mean, first of all, you know, you can talk about the challenges and the social policies and the government policies that have not built the housing. But even you put that off to the side, I think the fundamental question is that if there is a housing affordability problem specifically for working class families, and, you know, look, every community needs to have a balance of housing for different workers of different income stratas. But how and why you would make the assumption that that burden rests on a property owner to basically solve the citywide or region-wide housing problem it does not make any sense. I mean, I think the greater fear is that if in fact you do think that it is the landlord's responsibility to address a citywide housing problem, I mean, my big fear is that people then think, oh, good, the problem is solved because now we have just, you know, stuck it to the landlords.
Excuse me, Tom, I have to jump in here because we're coming up on a break. I want to give listeners an opportunity to join this conversation, really debating rent control, but also talking about suburbanization of rent control. It is migrating in a number of measures, or it's an attempt to have it migrate throughout the Bay Area here. Join us. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786 or email forum at kqed.org. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the struggle with soaring rents and voting going on rent control measures throughout the Bay Area. In Mountain View, it's nearly 60% of residents that are renters, and the average monthly rent jumped between 2011 and 2015 over 50%. And we've got a number of small cities that are involved with rent control measures, not only Mountain View, but Burlingame, San Mateo, and Oakland's trying to change things there and so forth. And we're having a debate, really, about rent control. And you are certainly welcome to join the discussion. Our email address is forum@kqed.org, and you can post questions or comments right onto our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle's @KQED Forum. We spoke earlier with Devin Katayama, KQED East Bay reporter, and the debate continues with Juliette Brody here in studio with us, Stanford Law professor, and Tom Bannon, CEO of the California Apartments Association. And before I go to your calls and emails, I want to go back to Tom Bannon because I think you were finishing a point, and I had to interrupt you, Tom, with apologies, but we have to go to break. We have to go to break.
Not a problem. Thanks, Michael. Yeah, I mean, what the point I was trying to make is that rent control doesn't solve the housing problem. And I think one of my concerns is that if, in fact, a community adopts rent control, I wouldn't want people to think you've now solved the housing affordability issue. I think, as a professor noted, that we need housing, and we don't want to take away from that. We just need housing to keep up with the jobs that are coming into the region.
Juliette Brody, you wanted to respond.
Yeah, well, I'm so glad that Tom and I agree on that. I wanted to respond to something that he said just before the break, though, about it somehow not being fair for landlords to bear, quote unquote, all the burden of the supply and demand problem. And I think this goes back to the really important point that I want people to understand, that landlords right now are it's that old question of you want the benefit without the burden. Landlords right now, because of the crazy hot market and the scarcity of housing that we have, landlords alone are reaping just an incredible amount of the profit that's coming out of these Silicon Valley high-paying jobs. And I think to have it can't be that landlords are entitled to get all that profit, but cry foul and market intervention when we try to put some kind of reasonable cap on that. And the other point I wanted to make in response is these rent stabilization, rent control 2.0 measures, I don't want your listeners to think that the results of these measures is that, well, we're just going to have to put these landlords into bad economic circumstances, but that's just the price we're going to have to pay. Landlords are going to do just fine. Keep in mind, Prop 13 caps their property taxes, which is the largest percentage of what they pay, their operating expenses. And those are frozen at about 2% by Prop 13. So the idea that rent control is going to be a death blow to the profitability of residential real estate investment, it's just not true.
But help me with something here, because I believe the Alameda measure requires landlords to provide financial assistance to tenants who are forced to move.
So many of these measures include something called relocation assistance. The Mountain View one does, although it's a bit complicated right now because the city council is tinkering with the underlying pre-existing relocation ordinance. Devin mentioned at the top that these measures include a just cause for eviction protection as well as rent stabilization. What that means is landlords cannot simply, if these measures pass, can't evict a tenant for no reason at all. They have to state and be able to prove one of several reasons. And those reasons themselves go into sort of two departments. One is the tenant has done something wrong, non-payment of rent, criminal activity, breach of the lease. Of course, the landlord can evict those people under state law, and no one would argue that they shouldn't be able to evict those folks. The other bucket, so to speak, of good cause to evict are economic reasons for the landlord, like they want to go out of the landlord business, the so-called Ellis Act evictions, or they need to demolish the building. Other sort of events that justify evicting a tenant, but the tenant hasn't done anything wrong. In the event of one of those kinds of evictions, many of these measures include relocation assistance. The city of Mountain View already had in place a relocation assistance ordinance, so this is not something that the rent control campaign has behind. The existing relocation ordinance in Mountain View provides those kinds of tenants with cash payment of 3 months' rent and a return of their security deposit.
Well, there are differences, as you suggested, in each of these measures. In Oakland, the cap would go from 10% to 5% a year. But also it would create a rent board with mainly tenants. So we are talking of measures that really are shifting a lot of things in terms of differences dramatically.
And one other feature of some of these measures, the Mountain View measure has what we call a decontrol mechanism, which in part out of the tenants' coalition's desire to be fair to landlords, if the market returns to sort of a reasonable rate, which people can disagree about what a good indicator of that is, but many economists use a 5% vacancy rate as a measure of sort of a stable competitive market. If the vacancy rate in Mountain View goes to 5%, they can turn off rent control. They can say, yeah, we only need this when it's an emergency, and it's an emergency.
Michael?
Yeah, I want to hear from you, Tom Bannon. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a little surprised that the issue is about profit, but let me just address that issue. What the professor said was that, you know, property owners have properties in 13, and they shouldn't be making this much profit. I mean, first of all, you know, a property owner makes a decision whether or not they're going to invest their money into a piece of rental property. They are taking a risk. They can put their money in rental property. They can buy stocks. They can buy, you know, an ice cream shop, whatever they want to do. So there is a risk associated with this. I mean, the other issue to keep in mind is that it is all based upon the economy. As the economy does well, a number of people do well. When the economy does not do well, then some people don't do well. The last dot-com explosion that took place where the economy tanked, a number of property owners found themselves, you know, with reducing rent significantly. So it is economy. I mean, the economics do drive it, but it is also about risk. The other thing that I want to say is that for a long period of time, a landlord and a tenant have a contract, and that contract is relatively simple. It says that an owner is going to provide a home for a tenant, and that contract can last for 1 month, 6 months, 9 months, a year. And that contract basically says that as the owner, I'm going to provide this unit to this tenant, and you're going to pay X amount of money, and you're going to agree to abide by the rules of that unit. All of those rules basically are legal. But I think the professor is being a little bit, quip in terms of the notion about evicting somebody. The notion that in a just cause eviction, which basically means that in order for somebody, for an owner to evict somebody prior to the term of that tenancy going away, if it's a 1 year tenancy, they agree for 1 year. If the tenant is engaged in some activity that the other residents in that community feel unsafe, they don't like it, and it verges on being illegal, the landlord has to go to court and has to prove to the court why they're going to break that lease. And so the notion criminal activity has to be proven. You basically, that if somebody's dealing drugs and the residents are going to tell the landlord that, then the landlord has to say to those tenants, well, you need to write a letter to me and give me proof so I can go to court and get these people out.
Now, we could obviously even open up a whole debate here just on this matter alone.
Yeah, I have to respond to that.
I have to go to callers because we have a lot of people who want to weigh in here. In fact, let me, before I go to calls, just give you a sampling of here's somebody who sides with Tom Bannon, anti-rent control, B, who writes, my parents owned a rent control apartment back building in Santa Monica back in the 80s. They were firmly middle class, and rent control destroyed them. As fees around them increased, they could not keep up with their bills. They also could not easily evict residents who were not paying their rent because of rent control laws at that time. And when they needed to sell the building, they had trouble because nobody wanted to be stuck with the rents they had to commit to. It was a total disaster. Here, on the other hand, is Barbara, a teacher, who writes, when I moved to the Bay Area 35 years ago, I knew that this was where I wanted to spend the rest of my life. But as a veteran middle school teacher in the San Mateo Foster City School District and the victim of a 60% rent increase, living in San Mateo is no longer affordable. I am voting yes on San Mateo's Measure Q so that our schools will be able to attract new teachers and to stop the loss of so many dedicated teaching professionals and school staff who are leaving the district due to the high cost of housing in the area. Let me go to your calls. And let's begin with Janet in Burlingame. You're on. Morning.
Hi. Hi, Michael. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a little nervous. I have listened to your show for over 25 years, and I've never called.
Well, it's about time. Welcome, and don't be nervous.
You have a great show. All right. I understand the problems of rent control. I totally get it. I feel this is a poorly written initiative. I have an 87-year-old mother. My mom and dad were married 61 years before my dad died. They worked 6 days a week, their small business in Burlingame, until they were 45. And then they kept working and working. They owned one house. That's all they bought their house. One house. My mom lives in Sterling Court. Her rent right now offsets her rent. It does not pay all the rent at Sterling Court, but it offsets it. What I don't like about the initiative from my mom is that, all right, so she is the lessor. The lessee is the tenant. If the lessee decides to sublet my mom's house, my mom has no control who moves into her home.
And that's your concern, understandably. Let me get Julia Brody to address that. Could you please, Professor Brody?
Of course. If my understanding is correct, and Barbara, I think your name is. I'm not sure I got the...
Janet.
Janet, thank you. Barbara was the email. If your mom owns a single-family home and she's renting it out, is that what you're saying?
Yes.
That is categorically exempt. Your mom's house will not be covered by this law. It is
in Burlingame, the way it's written, I understand that it is apartments and single-family residences.
No, under state law, under that Costa-Hawkins statute that we were talking about at the top of the hour.
Yeah, I think your mom is off the hook.
She's off the hook. She is off the hook. And the other could, if
but
I could,
not for just cause eviction. But not for just cause eviction.
That's correct. Not for just cause for eviction. And I want
So in fact,
please don't interrupt me. I wanted to talk about these just cause for evictions and the idea that it is somehow categorically unreasonable to have a landlord need to prove when a tenant has done something wrong. I mean, that's a much bigger problem. If that's your position, that's a much bigger problem than an issue with rent control. Under state law, rent control, these initiatives are not moving that needle at all. Under state law, if a landlord wants to evict a tenant during a lease term because they have done something wrong, whether it's not paying the rent or criminal activity on the premises, that landlord under state law has to go to court and prove that. So please do not put that at the feet of rent control. You might not like that. You might like to be able to just throw someone out.
Yeah, Tom Bannon wants to respond. But before you do, Tom, I want to follow up another question to Julia Brody, and that is per the last call about subletting. Is a renter allowed to sublet?
Different of the ordinances in general. I should look it up during the next break because, to be honest, it's one of the bells and whistles that I didn't review before this morning. I'll look it up.
Tom Bannon.
Yeah, I mean, just in terms of the professor's comments, let's take, for instance, you have a six-month lease. A landlord, basically, at the end of 6 months under existing law, can basically say to the tenant, you know, after 6 months, I'm either going to, raise the rent or, you know what, I'm not going to renew your lease. The challenge comes in where on that six-month lease, that prospective resident, maybe in the third month, is creating all kind of problems for the other residents in that community. And people don't want to hear this, but the reality is that if an individual is dealing drugs, what happens at the third month? If the landlord wants to evict that individual, third month, not 6 month, Professor, third month, they need to go to court and they need to prove that that individual is dealing drugs. The way you prove that somebody is dealing drugs or you convince the judge that the person is dealing drugs is, one, the person is convicted, not just arrested, convicted, or you get the other tenants in that apartment community to sign letters and to come forward and to say, we believe this person is dealing drugs. But that then puts those residents in a very difficult position because they know that that individual who they have accused could very well be there for another 3 months.
Okay,
so it is not as simple as you state.
All right, I do want to bring another caller in here, and I know you want to respond, Julia, but we do want to hear from our callers as well. Let me get Catherine on next. Catherine, go ahead.
Thank you, Michael. I'm Catherine Pauling with the Alameda Renters Coalition. So many topics I'd like to respond to, but one issue that has not been addressed is the fellow from the apartment association who is pouring hundreds of thousands, a huge amount of money, in opposition to our grassroots organization. I'm glad you mentioned about contracts and investments in a very competitive market, whether a home buyer or a renter. We have to show creditworthiness. They're doing a very strict 30% rent-to-income ratio. You have to qualify. There's lots of people who can qualify. You have to then be chosen. So within that, once we actually qualify and get into an apartment, what the gentleman would like to do is then be able to raise the amount, any amount, and it's happening, double-digit amounts each year, so that by the second year, a person can no longer stay in the home that they actually qualified for. So without some kind of stabilization, like the ones we put forth, a person can't stay in their home. The second thing is I want to urge that renters and homeowners alike all want stable, safe neighborhoods. We've chosen Alameda for its schools, its neighborhoods, its strong community. You start moving to a boom and bust, high turnover, and then he's already complained about when it dips, he had to lower the rent because it was placed too high, only for the top wage owners. And he had ousted all the regular people who lived and worked in that area. We are on the same page. We have homeowners in our organization and on our steering committee. We want strong schools, safe neighborhoods. And we want the contract that we signed as renters to be honored and respected over time.
All right, Catherine, I'm going to have to cut it there, and I thank you for the call. You've made your case, and we'll let it stand. But I want to go back, actually, to Professor Brody, because she was a bit chomping at the bit here to respond to that. I mean, is Tom Bannon incorrect when he says, you know, you have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, or you have to at least prosecute to get somebody just cause eviction?
He is absolutely incorrect that the standard is beyond a reasonable doubt, or that to evict a tenant, and I should say he's also incorrect that to convict a tenant, to evict a tenant for criminal activity requires a that the tenant have already been convicted.
Or that the other tenant sign the statement? Or?
I mean, I have lived in landlord-tenant court for the past 15 years of my career. It's what brought me to this work is eviction defense. And let me tell you, it is the fact that a landlord has to prove any of the grounds for eviction under state law. But the idea that it is difficult to convince a judge that a bad acting tenant needs to go.
Depends who the judge is, doesn't it?
Well, I'm just telling you, I've been sitting in San Mateo County Superior Court for 10 years, and it happens all day, every day. But the most important point here, two really important points. Number one, rent control. These rent stabilization measures that are on the ballot have nothing to do with this. For the California Apartment Association to try and turn this into a referendum on drug dealing tenants is just classic political scare tactics. These are state law provisions that already apply in every municipality in California. And the idea that rent stabilizations, just cause protections somehow now bring this new requirement, it's just incorrect. The point of the just cause protections in these measures is for the other evictions, the ones that are happening with no cause. The teacher, the working people, the nurses who live in these apartments right now, they've not done anything wrong. They don't deal drugs. They pay their rent. Their dog doesn't bark. Their kids don't make noise. And yet they get either a 60% rent increase, which is tantamount to an eviction notice, or they get a so-called no-cause eviction notice so that they can get out and turn the apartment over to someone who can pay much, much more because of the supply and demand problem.
All right, Tom Bannon, you're trying to scare people here?
No, not at all. I mean, if in fact this was just about rent control and this was not about changing the contracts, then there should not be anything in any of these measures that talk about changing the historical contracts that exist. And Professor, with all due respect, it is difficult to evict problem tenants today, even without the just cause provisions. And you may not want to hear about the drug dealer and those situations, but that's reality.
All right, I'm going to read a couple of comments here, and then I'm going to go over more of your calls, a pro comment and an anti comment. Patsy writes on the pro side, displacement is happening in rural areas such as Point Reyes and the rest of West Marin as well. People who have lived and worked here for decades are being priced out of rental units because of Airbnb, et cetera, and some greed. Businesses have trouble finding workers willing to commute. And here's Dave on the other side who says, Prop 13 was an extreme reaction to a short-term situation and is effectively permanent. It created distortions and dysfunctions too numerous to name here. These rent control initiatives, should they pass, will be permanent mistakes which will hobble housing markets in those cities forever. Have we learned nothing from Prop 13? And let me get another caller on. Scott, you're on. Morning.
Hey, good morning. My wife and I are blue collar, and we ended up buying a duplex with some good friends of ours maybe 12 years ago. With the intention of one day we're going to have to have some cash flow as we retire and get older, and I think with respect to rent control, I'm kind of like right smack dab in the middle. I totally feel for those people who are getting priced out, but I'm hesitant to just allow more government coming in and just basically telling me what I can do with my property. I mean, they do that already, but I'm not fearful, but cautious of that power growing. At the same time, I don't know where we're going to get the land on the peninsula to build more affordable housing unless we go vertical. And I think that homeowners, in my area at least, are very reluctant to let residential housing to go vertical. And here in America, we have, there's like a stigma around public housing. The images that we have of public housing or subsidized housing are not attractive images. I don't know if they're right or wrong, but that's just the image I have of public housing.
Well, Scott, I'm glad you brought that up. I'm actually looking. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I couldn't help bringing in the fact that a listener here wants to know how the elimination of redevelopment agencies is affecting the production of housing, particularly affordable housing. I think it's a very key question, but please finish your thought.
Well, I also wanted, it seems like an important point to resolve, because I do know of several people who live in San Francisco in rent-controlled units who actually sublet those for extended periods of time. They move in with parents, or they move in, you know, like an RV, you know, like we see in Palo Alto and El Camino. That seems like somebody just siphoning off the profit of the homeowner. And I just wanted to see, is that illegal, or is it, how is that contractually enforceable? Doesn't seem fair, as long as we're talking about fair. Thank you all very much.
All right, thank you. And we'll concede to the law professor here on that last question. Julia Brody?
Well, one other thing that hasn't been brought up yet is, well, I want to say a couple things. First of all, under some of these ordinances, I don't remember exactly what community the caller lives in, but duplexes in Mountain View are exempt. So just like the single family home caller who called before, if this gentleman lives in, if his duplex is in Mountain View, it would be exempt. The other point I wanted to make about the reasonableness of rent increases under these laws that hasn't come up yet is, it's important to note that just like these are not rent caps, these are not freezing rents at any given level because of vacancy decontrol, these laws also have a provision. Each and every one of them has a provision that if the landlord thinks that the rent increase is allowable under the law, so typically it's inflation, these are most of them pegged to the CPI, if they are not able to make a reasonable return on their property, they can go and petition to have the rent increase augmented.
Have you seen the research that was done by that Nevada-based firm, Real Answers? I just want to give it out to listeners here. For all units of all sizes in the Bay Area, rent has gone up to 66% or $1,000. That's up to an average of $2,504. I want to bring another caller in here, though. Although, question for you, Professor Brody from a listener named Brett. Please ask Julia Brody if she would be against rent control if inventory was sufficient, and if yes, how do you define sufficient?
Well, I think this goes back to what I said a few moments ago about economists debating what quote-unquote vacancy rate indicates a sort of healthy competitive market. Many use a 5% vacancy rate as as good as anything else. I'm certainly not an expert economist, but I do think that the purpose of these measures is to chill out a market when, you know, all markets have booms and have busts.
Now we've got limited time. I want to go back to Tom Bannon here because there's literally seconds left here for a quick question from a listener named Albert. Does your guest from the Apartments Association believe that homeowners should be means tested before they're protected? Why should we subsidize many homeowners that do not need to be subsidized? Tom Bannon?
I mean, I think that, you know, that if you're talking about a homeowner, basically a homeowner does, in fact, get qualified from the bank as they purchase their home. And they basically make a commitment on a 30-year agreement. If, in fact, if a tenant and a landlord want to do a 5-year lease and they want to lock it in at X amount of money, then you know what? The property owner is locked in at whatever that rate is. If they want to do a 6-month, then that's what they do.
We're going to leave it there because we are out of time. Let me thank you, Tom Bannon. Tom Bannon, again, is CEO of the California Apartments Association. And thank Juliet Brody, law professor at Stanford and director of the Stanford Community Law Clinic, which is representing the campaign for Yes on V. And I also want to thank Devin Katayama, East Bay reporter for KQED, who was with us before. Next hour, we're going to attempt to tackle in our election coverage what's on the ballot here in San Francisco, and there's a lot on that ballot, to be sure, about 25 measures, and certainly some races, and how's it all going to shape up. A lot of the future of San Francisco, many feel, is at stake, so stay tuned for that. And Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg. Engineer is Danny Bringer, engagement producer Amanda Stupai, and we get online support from Amanda Font. Our interns are Maxine Schofer-Wolf and Brandon Yu. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and executive producer is Joanne Wallace. I thank you for listening. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.